So, I want you to take a second and just think about the very last time you scrolled through the news. Just, picture it in your mind.
Oh yeah, that's always a stressful exercise.
Right. You're holding your phone, your thumb is swiping, and you're just getting hit with this relentless, heavy stream of headlines.
Just one after the other.
Exactly. You've got geopolitical conflicts flaring up in one region. You swipe again, and there's looming economic crisis warnings or inflation. You swipe again, it's an ecological disaster, a wildfire, a flood, a drought.
And it all feels so disconnected, but simultaneously overwhelming.
It really does. And woven through all of it is this deep, bitter political polarization that just seems to be tearing communities apart from the inside out. It's completely overwhelming.
Creates this feeling that we're basically just running around with fire extinguishers.
Yes, jumping from one isolated emergency to the next, just trying to stop the world from burning down. And this is the core of what we're talking about today. What if the lens we are using to look at all these events is completely flawed?
Which is a huge question to ask.
What if these aren't isolated emergencies at all? What if every single one of those heavy headlines is actually just a different symptom of a single, much deeper structural failure?
It's a profound shift in perspective to even ask that question, because we have this natural, almost hardwired tendency to view a conflict or a crisis as a discrete, isolated event.
Right, with a specific immediate cause.
Exactly. We look for the spark that started the fire,
Yeah.
but when you force yourself to step back and look at the entirety of the system, the economy, the environment, the political institutions, you start to see a hidden architecture beneath all that chaos.
The noise fades out.
The noise fades and the structural signals become clear. And that is exactly the terrain we're exploring today.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We have our hands on a truly fascinating white paper. It was published exactly today, March 5, 2026.
Fresh off the presses.
Literally today. The title is The Violence Viability Architecture: Life Ground Governance and the Stability of Civilizations. And honestly, the authorship of this paper it's just as intriguing, maybe even more so, than the title
Oh,
itself.
absolutely. It's incredibly unique.
It's co-authored by Dr. Bishara Saheeli, who is a physician and an incredibly sharp systems thinker, and wait for it, ChatGPT 5.3, and advanced artificial intelligence.
And the synergy of that partnership is what makes this document so unique. You have Dr. Saheeli bringing this deep human medical expertise.
Right, because as a physician, he has a literal hands-on understanding of biological systems.
Exactly. He knows what health actually looks like. He knows what happens when a complex organism begins to fail and struggle for survival. And he combines that with broad systems theory.
And then you add the AI into the mix.
Right. Acting as his co-author, you have ChatGPT 5.3, doing something no human mind could really do alone. It's synthesizing vast, staggering amounts of data across decades of peace research, global ecology, political economy, philosophy.
They are using this human-machine partnership to tackle what is arguably the ultimate complex problem: civilizational survival.
It's essentially the ultimate survival guide for humanity, written by a human doctor and an artificial intelligence.
So our mission in this deep dive is to take their massive synthesis and equip you with a completely new grammar for understanding human history and everything happening in the world right now.
We're going to unpack the interconnected layers of our ecology, our institutions, and our culture.
We're going to reveal the hidden architecture of stability and the hidden architecture of instability. I genuinely believe we are going to change the way you read the news forever. So grab a coffee, settle in. Okay, let's unpack this.
To understand the architecture of civilization, we really have to start at the absolute bedrock. In the paper, Dr. Saheeli and the AI introduce a concept originally developed by the philosopher John McMurtry. It's called the life ground.
The life ground, okay.
Now, in academic circles, this is sometimes referred to as life value onto axiology.
Okay, hold on. Onto axiology is a massive mouthful. We are going to need to break that down before we go any further. What does that actually mean in plain English?
Fair enough. It sounds intimidating, but it's actually a very elegant way of describing reality. Ontology is the philosophical study of being, of what actually exists in reality.
That is real.
And axiology is the study of value, of what is fundamentally good or worthwhile. So when McMurtry, and by extension the authors of this paper, talk about life value onto axiology, they are arguing that the ultimate objective baseline of all value in the universe is physical, biological life.
So the life ground is basically the biophysical substrate.
The biophysical and infrastructural substrate upon which human existence rests. It is the absolute foundation. Everything else, our economies, our laws, our art, our stock markets, is built on top of it.
That makes perfect sense because we don't live in the abstract. You and I, the listener sitting in their car or at their desk right now, we exist in physical bodies.
We have physical needs.
We need breathable air. We need drinkable water. We need agriculture that actually yields food. It's so incredibly easy to get caught up in fierce debates about interest rates or technological innovation or political ideology and completely forget that none of those things can exist without the life ground.
If the oxygen levels drop or the water supply turns toxic, your stock portfolio is irrelevant.
The app on your phone doesn't matter.
Precisely. The physical reality always wins out over the abstract systems. And to make this concrete, the paper meticulously maps out what it calls the 7 universal life necessities.
And these aren't just nice to haves, right?
Not at all. These aren't preferences. These are the non-negotiable conditions required for human survival and for the development of human capacities. They are a deeply interconnected web. The first one is water systems.
And we aren't just talking about having a glass of tap water when you're thirsty.
No. We are talking about the immediate necessity for human metabolism, yes, but also the massive hidden sanitation networks that prevent entire cities from succumbing to cholera.
Right, the plumbing, the sewage.
And the vast hydrological systems required for agriculture. Without functioning water systems at a macro level, a civilization halts within days.
Which feeds directly into the second necessity. Food systems. This is another area where I think we take the underlying infrastructure completely for granted.
Oh, absolutely.
This necessity encompasses everything from the microbial health of the soil and agricultural lands to the vitality of global fisheries to the mind-bogglingly complex logistics of distribution. Think about what it takes to get an avocado or a tomato from a farm in one hemisphere to your local grocery store in another.
It requires a functioning, highly orchestrated global machine.
Massive. And the third necessity.
The third brings in Dr. Sahili's explicit medical perspective. Health and care systems. A civilization relies on a constantly updating body of medical knowledge, functioning hospitals, and robust public health infrastructure.
To protect populations from disease and physical injury.
Exactly. If you look at history, preventable illnesses or pandemics can rapidly destabilize entire empires if the health infrastructure isn't there to absorb the shock.
Fourth on the list is energy systems. And again, this isn't just about plugging in your television.
No, energy systems are the vital flows that power modern transportation, global communication networks, and the immense social coordination required for any modern economy to function.
Without energy, the logistics of the food system freeze and the water treatment plants shut down. It's all connected.
Then we have the fifth necessity, which is arguably the grand container that holds all the physical elements together. Ecological stability.
So we're talking about macroscopic climate regulation.
Maintaining soil fertility across continents, preserving biodiversity, keeping those global hydrological cycles running. The natural world isn't just a pretty backdrop for human drama.
It's the literal machine keeping us alive.
Yes. If the ecology destabilizes, every other physical necessity we just listed is immediately threatened.
And the paper doesn't just stop at the biological, which I found fascinating. It moves into the cognitive and social realms for the final two necessities. The sixth is knowledge and education infrastructures.
Which might surprise some people.
Right. Why is that considered a universal life necessity on par with water? Because a civilization must cultivate cognitive development. It has to transmit cultural norms, but more importantly, it has to teach technical knowledge across generations.
If we stop teaching the next generation how to maintain the water treatment plants, the life ground degrades just as surely as if there were a drought.
That is a crucial point. Knowledge is the software that runs the physical hardware of civilization.
Finally, the seventh necessity is social cooperation systems. These are the legal frameworks, the governance structures, and the institutions that manage collective action and resolve disputes.
Because without a mechanism to cooperate and peacefully allocate resources, the entire system fractures into chaotic, individualistic survival mode.
Which inevitably destroys the life ground.
So we have these seven necessities: water, food, health, energy, ecology, knowledge, and social cooperation. They form this tight, interconnected web. And what Dr. Sahili and the AI point out is the terrifying reality of cascading failures.
They map out a very specific, chilling example in the text to show how this works. Let's walk through it. Imagine a severe, prolonged drought hits a major agricultural region.
Okay, so that is a disruption in necessity number 5, ecological stability.
Exactly. And that ecological disruption immediately hits necessity number one, water systems. The reservoirs drop.
And when there is less water, agricultural yields plummet, which is a direct hit to necessity number two, food systems.
And when food systems fail, the grocery store shelves empty out, leading to massive price spikes. Suddenly, basic nutrition becomes unaffordable for a huge segment of the population.
This creates severe economic stress.
And that economic stress immediately strains necessity number seven, social cooperation systems. Mm. The government is suddenly facing protests, anger, and demands for relief.
Meanwhile, the lack of affordable nutrition triggers necessity number three, health and care systems. You have a spike in malnutrition and stress-related illnesses, overwhelming hospitals.
So what started as a lack of rain, an ecological event, cascades through the entire architecture of the civilization, destabilizing the economy, the government, and public health.
One node fails and the whole system shakes.
Exactly.
Seeing it laid out like that really forces a reevaluation of how we run things. It brings us to what the authors call the civilizational purpose problem. And I want everyone listening to really ponder this question for a moment. What is our society actually built to do?
It's a great thought experiment.
If an alien anthropologist came down, studied our global civilization, looked at our laws, our tax codes, and our daily activities, what would they conclude our primary objective was?
If you look at how we measure success globally right now, the conventional answers are incredibly clear. Our primary objectives seem to be maximizing gross domestic product, achieving military dominance over rivals, or driving relentless, unchecked technological progress for its own sake.
But the white paper introduces a radical, fundamental premise. It argues that the objective ultimate purpose of any governance structure of civilization itself is not economic growth.
The purpose is to sustain and expand the life ground.
It's a complete paradigm shift. It flips the script entirely. The paper argues that when societies pursue short-term economic growth at the direct expense of ecological stability, when they extract resources faster than the earth can replenish them just to boost quarterly profits, they aren't just making a bad policy choice.
They are creating fundamental, fatal contradictions.
They are actively destroying the very foundation that allows their economy to exist in the first place.
And this is where the physics of complex systems comes into play. When that foundation begins to crack, when the life ground is degraded, the resulting pressure doesn't just evaporate, it moves upward.
It travels from the physical ecology into our human institutions, into our communities, and into our daily lives.
This tension radically alters how we interact with one another, which brings us to a major section of the paper, rethinking how we traditionally understand harm, conflict, and violence.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This part of the deep dive absolutely blew my mind, because we have to completely shift our definition of violence. To do this, Dr. Sakali and the AI bring in a brilliant conceptual framework from the foundational peace researcher Johann Galtung. It's called the violence triangle.
To understand the triangle, we have to recognize that our standard definition of violence is incredibly narrow. We usually only see the very tip of the iceberg.
Right, the stuff we see on the news.
Galtung calls this top corner of the triangle direct violence. These are the highly visible, tangible acts: wars, riots, physical assaults, terrorism. It is a clearly identifiable perpetrator holding a weapon and an identifiable victim suffering immediate physical harm.
And because it is highly visible, it is what our legal systems, our police forces, and our militaries are almost entirely focused on addressing.
But I know what you're probably thinking, and it's a valid pushback.
Yeah, I can hear some listeners objecting right now, and honestly, I had the same reaction at first. If we start expanding the definition of violence beyond someone throwing a punch or dropping a bomb, don't we dilute the word?
Exactly.
If a hospital is underfunded, that's terrible public policy. But is it really helpful to call it violence? How do we differentiate between a systemic failure and an actual physical attack?
That is the exact pushback this theory always receives, and it's a vital question. The authors defend this expanded definition by focusing on the outcome rather than the intent.
The outcome.
Whether a person's life is cut short by a bullet or cut short by preventable malnutrition because they live in a society that restricts their access to food, the ultimate outcome, the destruction of human capacity and the violation of the life ground, is functionally identical.
It's the same result at the end of the day.
This brings us to the second corner of the triangle, structural violence.
Let's unpack structural violence deeply, because this is the hidden engine of the whole framework. The paper defines structural violence as the hidden deprivation embedded within a system.
It happens when social institutions, legal frameworks, and economic systems systematically restrict a group's access to the life ground.
Structural violence is insidious precisely because there is no single identifiable perpetrator holding a weapon.
Right. It is embedded in the normal, everyday functioning of the economy. It is written into the zoning laws and the tax codes.
It is experienced by marginalized populations as an inevitable, tragic condition of life, rather than as a discrete, malicious attack. But the harm is just as real, and statistically, it is often far more lethal and widespread than direct violence.
Think about food deserts. This is a perfect modern example. Imagine a neighborhood where the nearest grocery store selling fresh produce is 10 miles away, and the local population relies on underfunded public transit.
They're surrounded by fast food and convenience stores selling highly processed, nutrient-poor items.
No one is physically attacking the residents of this neighborhood.
Okay.
But the economic structure of the city has violently restricted their access to necessity number two, food systems.
Over a decade, that leads to skyrocketing rates of diabetes, heart disease, and lowered life expectancy. According to this paper, that isn't just a market inefficiency. That is a structural act of violence against that community's life ground.
Exactly. Another stark example from the text is environmental degradation coupled with political powerlessness. Suppose an industrial manufacturing plant is legally permitted to pollute a local river.
The community living downstream relies on that watershed, but they lack the lobbying power or the financial resources to fight the corporation in court.
They suffer chronic health issues, developmental delays in their children, and shortened lifespans. Again, no army invaded their town, but the legal and economic structure violently restricted their access to necessity number one, water systems.
Or consider education disparities. If a society funds its schools based purely on local property taxes, it structurally guarantees that children born into poorer zip codes will receive substandard access to necessity number six. Knowledge infrastructures. It locks entire demographics into generational poverty.
So if this structural violence is happening everywhere all the time and it is actively harming massive segments of the population, it begs a massive question.
How do societies tolerate this? If people are being systematically deprived of the fundamental necessities of life, why doesn't the system immediately collapse? Why don't people brain it all down?
That is the critical question. And it brings us to the third and final corner of Galtung's triangle, cultural violence.
Oh, okay.
A society cannot maintain deep structural inequality relying purely on force. It requires moral legitimation. Cultural violence consists of the prevailing narratives, the myths, and the ideologies that a society uses to justify both structural inequality and direct violence.
It's the stories we tell ourselves so we can sleep at night. It's how we make the unfairness feel not just acceptable, but somehow natural or divinely ordained. How do you justify locking millions of people out of the life ground? You use cultural narratives.
The authors point to several pervasive ways this manifests. A prime example is the cultural narrative surrounding extreme meritocracy.
Oh, this is a big one.
If a culture relentlessly insists that any individual who is poor simply didn't work hard enough or lacks innate talent, it performs a brilliant psychological trick.
It completely obscures the structural factors, the underfunded schools, the generational wealth gaps, the polluted environments that restricted their opportunities from birth.
The systemic harm inflicted by the society is suddenly reframed as a personal, individual moral failure.
And once you believe it's their own fault, they don't have access to the life ground, you don't have to fix the structure.
Another example the text highlights is historical narratives that glorify conquest and domination. If a culture celebrates the subjugation of other groups as a heroic, manifest destiny, it normalizes direct violence as a tool of progress.
But perhaps the most dangerous form of cultural violence is when a society portrays marginalized or competing groups as inherently dangerous, inferior, or undeserving.
That is the mechanism of scapegoating. If you can convince the general public that a certain demographic group is an active threat to their way of life, then depriving that group of resources or even eventually attacking them directly is no longer seen as an act of aggression.
It is culturally reframed as an act of noble self-defense.
So when we put all three corners together, structural, cultural, and direct violence, we don't just have a list of bad things, we have an engine.
We have a vicious, self-reinforcing cycle.
Yes. The paper maps out exactly how this triangle feeds itself. It operates as a systemic property of a failing civilization. It almost always begins when institutions mismanage the life ground. perhaps due to resource scarcity or corruption.
This creates deep structural inequality, structural violence.
This deprivation creates immense social tension, fear, and legitimate grievances among the population.
Right. The pressure cooker is building. And instead of fixing the structure, cultural violence steps in to manage the pressure. The culture generates narratives to justify the inequality, usually by pointing the finger at a scapegoat.
The tension continues to build, the rhetoric gets hotter and hotter, until it finally reaches a boiling point and erupts into direct violence, a riot in the streets, a civil war, an uprising, or an international conflict.
And this is the most tragic part of the cycle. Once that direct violence occurs, what happens to the society? The violence hardens the cultural narratives.
The opposing side is no longer just a political rival. They are now viewed as an active, physical threat who just committed an act of violence.
This newly hardened cultural narrative is then used to justify even deeper structural divides. The government might pass harsher, more restrictive laws. They might further deprive the opposing group of resources in the name of security.
Which, of course, creates more structural violence, more tension, and the cycle accelerates. Violence in this framework is never an isolated episodic event.
It is a systemic property of a civilization that has lost its alignment with the life ground.
That is exactly right.
That is incredibly heavy, but it makes so much intuitive sense. If people are systematically cut off from the things they need to survive, the system is going to shake. But how human beings react to that shaking is fascinating and honestly a little terrifying.
It reveals a lot about our cognitive defaults.
I want you to imagine, right now, living through a sudden, catastrophic economic crash. Or imagine a massive environmental disaster where your city's water supply is contaminated for months. Think about the visceral fear, the uncertainty about how you were going to feed your kids.
In moments of intense vulnerability like that, human beings crave simple explanations.
The cognitive load of trying to understand global supply chains or complex ecological degradation is just too high. We want to know why we are suffering, and more importantly, we want to know who is to blame.
And this brings us to a deep psychological analysis within the paper. The authors introduce the concept of cultural attractors. When a society experiences profound systemic stress, when the life ground is threatened and the foundation is shaking, populations instinctively fall back on ingrained cognitive shortcuts and narrative patterns.
These attractors operate almost like gravity.
They pull complex, nuanced public discourse down into highly simplified, emotionally charged, and intensely polarized interpretations of reality.
The paper identifies three main cultural attractors. I guarantee you will recognize these from your history classes, and sadly, you will recognize them from reading the news this morning. Let's walk through them. The first attractor is an acronym. CMT. It stands for chosenness, myth, and trauma.
CMT is an incredibly powerful ancient narrative framework. It consists of three interlocking elements. Chosenness is the deeply held belief that a specific community or nation has a unique, sacred, or historically superior mission.
They believe they are special in the eyes of history or the divine.
Myth involves the symbolic stories, often romanticized, that encode a society's origins, its golden age, and its core moral lessons.
And finally, trauma refers to the collective intergenerational memories of deep historical suffering, persecution, or injustice inflicted upon the group.
Now, none of those things are inherently evil on their own. Shared myths and acknowledging historical trauma are part of any culture. But the danger, as Dr. Saheeli and the AI point out, is how CMT weaponizes identity when a society is placed under stress.
When a civilization facing a complex economic or ecological crisis activates the CMT attractor, every new challenge is immediately viewed through the lens of their historical trauma.
Exactly. A modern dispute over a border or a complex disagreement over trade tariffs and resource allocation isn't treated as a logistical problem to be solved. It is instantly interpreted as a repetition of a past historical persecution.
When a population deeply believes they are uniquely chosen by history, but also perpetually and unfairly victimized, any attempt at diplomatic compromise feels like a moral betrayal of their ancestors.
It makes practical problem solving almost impossible.
Which leads perfectly into the second cultural attractor. The acronym for this one is DMA. It stands for Dualism, Manichaeism, and Armageddon. This attractor operates by progressively simplifying and polarizing social reality. Let's break this down. Dualism is easy enough to grasp, right?
Yes. Dualism is simply the cognitive tendency to slice a complex, multifaceted world into simple binary opposites. It's order versus chaos, civilization versus barbarism, us versus them.
It's a very basic way the human brain categorizes information to save energy.
Right. But then the attractor turns the dial up with Manichaeism. Manichaeism takes that simple us versus them binary and injects it with extreme absolute moral weight.
It's no longer just a disagreement over tax policy or water rights. It becomes a cosmic struggle of pure good versus pure evil.
And once you have established that your side is pure good and the opposing side is pure evil, you inevitably arrive at the third element, Armageddon.
This is the belief that because the other side is inherently irredeemably evil, the conflict cannot be resolved through negotiation or structural reform. It can only end in a final, decisive, apocalyptic victory where the evil is eradicated.
You can see how this absolutely destroys any capacity for nuance. Systemic challenges like figuring out how to transition an energy grid or dealing with global resource scarcity are incredibly complex. They require careful, iterative, cooperative solutions.
But when the DMA attractor takes hold of a culture, it reduces these incredibly complex survival challenges to comic book battles. You can't sit down and negotiate a water treaty with pure evil. You can only try to destroy it.
The third attractor the authors identify operates on a deeply subconscious, psychological level. It is called RP repression and projection.
This is heavily drawn from psychoanalytic theory, but applied at a macro societal level.
Societies, like individuals, often repress uncomfortable truths about their own internal failures. If a society has deep, festering internal inequality, massive political corruption, or if they are actively destroying their own ecological life ground, acknowledging that reality is incredibly painful.
It challenges their entire national self-image. So, collectively, they repress it. They refuse to look at it.
But the laws of physics and psychology dictate that internal pressure has to go somewhere. You can't just ignore a degrading life ground forever. So what does the society do?
They project the blame for their internal suffering onto external actors. They find foreign enemies or they find minority groups within their own borders, and they say, they are the reason our economy is failing. They are the reason our lives are getting harder.
It acts as a massive psychological defense mechanism. If your domestic economy is failing because of outdated, structurally violent laws, it is so much easier to blame a foreign competitor than to do the grueling work of rewriting your own legal code.
It provides the society with a temporary hit of psychological relief.
It does provide relief, but that relief comes at a terrible, often fatal cost. It completely prevents actual adaptation. If a society constantly projects its internal systemic failures onto an external scapegoat, they will never, ever fix the actual cracks in their own life ground.
They will continue to degrade until they collapse, all while shaking their fists at an imagined enemy.
Now, this raises an important question, and we need to pause and be very, very clear here. The authors make a vital caveat in the paper. Historical traumas are often very real. A group may have actually suffered horrific persecution.
Right.
Furthermore, external threats and aggressive geopolitical rivals do exist in the real world. Acknowledging these psychological attractors does not mean we pretend every threat is imaginary or that everyone is just projecting.
Precisely. The danger and the explicit warning in this framework is not that these things don't exist. The danger is when these narrative frameworks become the only lens through which a society views the world.
When CMT, DMA, and repression projection completely hijack the public discourse, they blind a society to its own internal structural decay. It becomes a fatal blind spot.
We are discussing these as universal human phenomena. These are psychological traps that any society, regardless of its political system or geography, can fall into when the pressure on the life ground gets too high.
So these are the tracks that lead to the violence triangle and ultimately to collapse. How does a civilization avoid them? How does a society survive a changing environment?
This brings us to what might be my favorite part of the paper, a brilliant biological analogy that the authors use to explain the viability regulatory stack.
It is a deeply elegant way to understand governance. Think of human civilization not as a machine, but as a living, breathing organism. How does any organism, a human body, a forest ecosystem, survive in a rapidly changing, sometimes hostile environment?
It survives through layered regulation. Our biological bodies do this automatically without us even thinking about it.
But our societies have to consciously build institutions to perform these same regulatory functions. The paper maps out four distinct layers of this civilizational architecture of adaptation.
Let's climb the stack. The first fundamental baseline layer is homeostasis. This corresponds to routine, everyday maintenance.
In your physical body, homeostasis is what keeps your internal temperature stable at 98.6 degrees, regardless of whether it's hot or cold outside.
In a civilization, homeostasis is the baseline infrastructure functioning normally. It's the water treatment plants filtering out bacteria day after day. It's the power grids humming along. It's the supply chains reliably delivering food to the grocery store shelves.
When this layer is working effectively, daily life is stable, predictable, and mostly boring in a good way.
But the external environment is never perfectly stable. Shocks happen, and when they do, you need layer two. Allostasis.
Allostasis is the capacity for short-term adjustment and flexibility under stress. It's the ability to shift the baselines temporarily. If a severe drought hits, routine homeostasis fails because the water supply literally drops.
Allostasis kicks in when the city government implements emergency water conservation rules or when the agricultural sector rapidly shifts water allocation.
Or think of a hospital. Homeostasis is the normal ER wait time. Allostasis is the hospital rapidly reorganizing into emergency triage mode during a sudden, unexpected disease outbreak. It is the system flexing its muscles to absorb a shock without breaking.
This reminds me so vividly of the pandemic supply chain issues we all lived through. Suddenly, the entire world realized how fragile our civilizational allostasis really is.
When you couldn't find toilet paper, or more seriously, when parents couldn't find baby formula, we were watching the regulatory stack shake in real time.
We saw what happens when a shock exceeds the system's capacity to flex.
That is a perfect visceral example. The system flexed as hard as it could, but it revealed deep vulnerabilities. And that brings us to the crucial limitation of allostasis. You cannot stay in emergency mode forever.
A body cannot sustain a permanent adrenaline rush, and a society cannot live under permanent emergency decrees.
If the environment changes permanently, say, a permanent shift in the global climate that requires layer three, adaptation.
Adaptation involves long-term, fundamental structural reform. It's not just tweaking the existing system, it's building a new one.
If the climate permanently alters the hydrological cycle in a region, adaptation means inventing entirely new, drought-resistant agricultural crops.
It means undertaking the massive generational project of transitioning an entire national energy grid from fossil fuels to decentralized renewables. Adaptation requires immense financial investment, technological innovation, and crucially, institutional courage.
And how does a society generate that institutional courage? How does it know when to adapt? That requires the fourth and highest level of civilizational cognition, reflexivity.
Reflexivity is conscious, societal reevaluation. This is society looking collectively in the mirror and having the courage to ask the hardest, most uncomfortable questions.
Are our core values actually destroying our life ground? Is our economic system inherently structurally violent? Are we relying on cultural attractors to hide our failures?
The authors emphasize a point here that gave me chills. Societies that lack reflexivity, societies that actively suppress open debate, that punish critical inquiry, or that become entirely captured by those polarized cultural attractors we discussed earlier, are ultimately doomed to collapse.
Why? Because without reflexivity, they cannot correct their foundational errors.
If a society cannot reflexively recognize that its institutions are violently misaligned with the life ground, it will just keep pushing the pedal to the metal, degrading its own survival systems until it crosses a point of absolute no return.
Reflexivity is the immune system against civilizational hubris. Without it, you are flying blind into a storm.
Okay, so we have laid out all the pieces of this massive puzzle. We have the life ground and its seven necessities. We have the hidden systemic engine of the violence triangle. We understand the cultural narratives that blind us. And we have the four layers of the regulatory stack. How do Dr. Smelly and the AI put all of this together to help us see where we are actually heading?
They synthesize all of these concepts into a spatial model. They ask us to visualize a map.
I want you listening to visualize this in your mind right now. Picture a massive 3D topographic map. It has deep valleys, steep slopes, and high precarious ridges. This is what the paper calls the civilizational stability landscape.
In this conceptual landscape, a healthy, functioning, viable civilization sits at the very bottom of a deep valley. This area is called the Basin of Stability.
Down here in the valley, everything is working. The ecological systems are regenerating, the institutional governance is equitable, and the cultural narratives promote cooperation.
Disturbances still happen down here, maybe a bad harvest one year or a temporary market dip, but the society has gravity on its side. The regulatory stack, specifically those first two layers of homeostasis and allostasis, easily absorbs the shocks. The society naturally settles back into the bottom of the valley. It is deeply resilient.
But what happens when that stress isn't temporary? What happens when there is systemic drift?
This is where the landscape becomes dangerous. when ecological degradation steadily worsens over decades, when structural inequality systematically rises, and when political institutions become too rigid or corrupt to adapt, the society is slowly, incrementally pushed up the steep side of the valley.
This incline is the slope of systemic drift.
And what's terrifying about the slope is that the society is technically still functioning. The trains might still be running on time. The stock market might even be hitting all-time highs.
But the underlying reality is that the society is becoming incredibly dangerously fragile. It is expending massive amounts of energy, both physical and psychological, just to maintain the illusion of the status quo while perched on a steep incline.
And as the structural violence increases, the society gets pushed higher and higher up that slope until it approaches the very top of the hill. The paper identifies this peak as the threshold ridge. It is the ultimate tipping point.
So what does this all mean? It means that change, which has been agonizingly slow and gradual for decades as they crept up the slope, suddenly becomes rapid, chaotic, and terrifying.
Once a civilization is pushed completely over that threshold ridge, the regulatory systems fail entirely. Homeostasis breaks down. The water stops flowing. Allostasis is overwhelmed. The emergency rooms can't take any more patients.
The authors break down exactly what happens in the aftermath of crossing that tipping point. They identify four potential post-threshold trajectories. This is the choose-your-own-adventure for a civilization in crisis.
The first trajectory is restorative adaptation. This is the hopeful, albeit incredibly difficult, path. In this scenario, the shock of crossing the threshold forces a massive awakening.
The society's reflexivity kicks into overdrive. They realize they are on the brink. They successfully execute massive, rapid structural reforms. They begin repairing the ecology, and they manage to navigate their way back down the slope into the stable valley.
The second trajectory is chronic instability. This is a miserable existence. This is a society that gets pushed onto the ridge and just bounces along the top of it. They suffer repeated, cascading crises.
They have a massive financial crash. Just as they start to recover, they are hit with an unprecedented ecological disaster. That triggers a political uprising.
They implement partial band-aid solutions, just enough allostasis to avoid total annihilation, but they never achieve the deep adaptation required to get off the ridge. They never fully collapse, but they never regain true stability. It is a state of perpetual generational exhaustion.
The third trajectory is the one we all fear: collapse. This is the worst case scenario. This happens when there is a complete, unrecoverable failure of the regulatory stack.
The physical infrastructure breaks down entirely, the water and sewage systems halt, the institutions dissolve into corruption or impotence, and massive direct violence erupts as the society literally tears itself apart, fighting over the remaining fragments of the degraded life ground.
And then there is the fourth trajectory, which is perhaps the most fascinating: transformational transition. This occurs when the old system doesn't just adapt, it radically, fundamentally reorganizes into a completely new paradigm.
The civilization realizes the old valley is gone forever. We're talking about adopting fundamentally new economic models that aren't based on infinite extraction. Entirely new forms of decentralized, equitable governance.
A completely redefined symbiotic relationship with the life ground. It is a civilizational rebirth, but it is a rebirth born out of absolute necessity at the very edge of the cliff.
To help us understand where any given society, including our own global civilization, currently sits in this treacherous landscape, the authors provide a powerful analytical tool. They call it the metafigure, or the viability phase diagram. It takes all of this theory and maps it onto a simple graph with two axes.
The horizontal axis measures alignment with the life ground. Are your policies protecting and regenerating your ecology and physical infrastructure, or are you actively degrading them?
The vertical axis measures institutional and cultural coherence. Are your institutions trusted? Are your cultural narratives cooperative? Or is your society fragmented, deeply unequal, and politically polarized?
This creates four distinct quadrants. In the top right quadrant, you have high life ground alignment and high social coherence. This is the stable civilization.
In the bottom right quadrant, you have the fragility zone. In this state, the physical ecology might still be holding on the water, might still be flowing, but institutions are fragmenting, inequality is rising, and politics are severely polarizing.
The bottom left quadrant is collapse. The ecology is utterly degraded, and the institutions have failed entirely.
And finally, the top left quadrant represents transformation. The institutions are highly coherent and cooperative, but they are managing a fundamental, urgent shift away from a degraded life ground toward a completely new survival model.
The authors note a classic, deeply tragic trajectory of historical decline that you see over and over in history. Civilizations rarely jump straight from stability to collapse. They almost always move from the top right down to the bottom right and finally to the bottom left.
From stability to fragility to collapse. And the crucial takeaway here is that the warning signs almost always appear in the institutional and cultural coherence first.
You see the rise of the violence triangle, the extreme political polarization, the narrative warfare, and the structural inequality long before the physical infrastructure completely gives way. The social fabric tears before the water stops flowing.
This predictive capability is exactly why Dr. Saley and ChatGPT didn't just write a theoretical philosophy paper. They built a practical, actionable tool based on this framework. They created a diagnostic worksheet.
This is how policymakers or any citizen listening right now can evaluate the news and objectively measure the decisions being made by our leaders. There are five distinct dimensions to this diagnostic tool.
Let's run a hypothetical modern scenario through these five dimensions right now. Imagine there's a massive debate in your country over a new sweeping national energy initiative.
A certain faction wants to vastly expand the extraction of a specific natural resource, let's say deep sea mining, or massive new fracking operations, arguing it will create thousands of jobs and boost the GDP. How do we evaluate this using the paper's framework?
We start with dimension one, life ground impact. When this massive extraction policy is proposed, the very first question must be, does this policy protect or degrade the ecology and the vital physical infrastructure?
If the extraction process boosts the GDP by 2%, but severely contaminates a major regional watershed or permanently destroys an ecosystem critical for climate regulation, it catastrophically fails. Dimension one, it is a net negative for viability.
Dimension two is institutional alignment. We look at the policy and ask, does this initiative improve equitable access to the seven universal life necessities for the general population?
Or does the structure of the policy consolidate the new resources and the financial windfalls into the hands of a very small corporate elite while socializing the environmental risks?
Dimension three focuses the lens directly on structural violence. Does the action being taken actually reduce systemic inequality?
If the new mining operations are intentionally placed near marginalized communities who lack the political power to demand environmental protections, then the policy is actively intensifying the hidden deprivation within the society. It is an act of structural violence.
Dimension four is where we look at the rhetoric. This is cultural narrative effects. How are the politicians and the media selling this policy to the public? Does the rhetoric promote cooperation, scientific understanding, and shared responsibility?
Or does it activate those polarizing cultural attractors we talked about? Are proponents using dualism and Manichaeism, saying that anyone who opposes the mining is an enemy of progress or unpatriotic? Are they relying on repression and projection to force the policy through?
And finally, dimension five is the viability outcome. This is the synthesis of the first four dimensions. You tally the score.
Does the sum total of these affects the ecological damage, the resource consolidation, the structural violence, and the polarizing rhetoric push the civilization back toward the safe basin of stability? Or does it push us further up the dangerous slope of systemic drift toward the threshold ridge?
It is such a clarifying way to look at the world. You strip away the political theater and you just look at the physics of survival. This entire diagnostic framework leads to the ultimate, inescapable conclusion of the white paper.
We have to completely, fundamentally change the way we govern ourselves. The authors call this new paradigm life ground governance.
Life ground governance demands a massive paradigm shift. It requires moving away from the reactive, chaotic crisis management that defines our current era, running around putting out the fires you mentioned at the very beginning of the deep dive.
We must shift to preventive governance. It means our entire civilizational objective must shift.
The ultimate goal of our global economy, our legal frameworks, and our cultural values must be explicitly, unapologetically aligned with recognizing strict ecological and social constraints. We have to start governing as if our physical survival actually matters more than abstract growth.
Okay, let's take a deep breath. We have taken you on an absolutely massive journey today. We started at the fundamental physical bedrock of reality, the life ground, the non-negotiable universal necessities of water, food, energy, and ecology.
We ventured into the hidden, insidious depths of the violence triangle, exposing how deeply embedded structural inequality and cultural myths lay the quiet groundwork for explosive physical conflict.
We unpacked the psychological stories, the attractors of chosenness, dualism, and projection that we cling to when we are terrified by systemic stress.
And we mapped it all out on a 3D topographic landscape of civilizational collapse and rebirth, complete with a 5-dimension diagnostic tool to measure our trajectory.
The intention of this deep dive and the intention of the authors is to provide you with a powerful new lens. When you truly understand this architecture, the overwhelming, chaotic noise of the daily news cycle begins to make a very different, much clearer kind of sense.
It truly does.
I genuinely hope this framework changes your daily perspective. Tomorrow morning, when you open your phone and read a headline about a sudden conflict or an economic shock or a political crisis, I challenge you to pause. Look past the immediate direct violence. Search for the structural violence hidden beneath it.
Ask yourself, who in this scenario is being systematically cut off from the life ground?
Listen closely to the speeches of the leaders involved and look for the cultural attractors. Are they using dualism and Armageddon to justify their aggressive actions? Are they projecting their own internal failures onto external enemies? Once you see this matrix operating, I promise you, you cannot unsee it.
Before we conclude today, I want to leave you with a final lingering thought. It is a thought that builds explicitly on the incredibly unique context of the source material we analyzed today.
Like the co-authorship.
Exactly. Remember earlier, we discussed how the paper lists knowledge and education infrastructures as one of the 7 non-negotiable universal life necessities. It is a core part of the life ground. Furthermore, the paper forcefully states that reflexivity, the conscious societal self-evaluation of our deepest values and our foundational errors, is the highest, most crucial layer of our civilizational regulatory stack.
Without reflexivity, a civilization cannot adapt, and it collapses. It's our societal immune system.
But look at the authorship of the very diagnostic framework we just spent an hour exploring. It was co-authored by Dr. Seha Healy, a human, and ChatGPT 5.3, an AI. If an artificial intelligence is now capable of synthesizing the data and co-authoring the ultimate diagnostic manual for human civilizational survival, we are forced to ask a profound question. How does AI fundamentally alter that reflexivity layer of our regulatory stack?
Wow.
Are we as a species beginning to outsource our civilizational self-reflection to the very technological systems that are rapidly changing our environment?
That is really something to chew on. If the machine is the one holding up the mirror and telling us how to save ourselves, are we actually being reflexive? Or are we just handing the hard work of self-awareness over to the algorithm?
It's the ultimate question for our era.
Is artificial intelligence going to be the vital tool that finally gives us the capacity to navigate a transformational transition? Or is it the ultimate seductive blind spot that is going to quietly push us right over the threshold ridge while we aren't looking? I am going to let you ponder that one on your own time. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. It has been an absolute mind bender of a topic, and we loved unpacking it with you. Stay curious, keep looking beneath the surface, and we will catch you next time.